Hello and welcome to this special episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaac, and I'm with my wonderful co-host, Natalie Bellini. And why I say it's a special episode is because we try, I mean, I guess every episode is special, but we try when something new comes out that we really want to let our listeners and viewers hear about it and kind of hear our take on it. So recently, yesterday, published in New England Journal of Medicine was an editorial about the use of semaglutide in type 1 diabetes given at new onset and talking about how that can affect potentially helping people to not have to be on mealtime insulin or get off of insulin. So Natalie, I know you're very well versed in this topic. So can you give us a little bit of background about this?
Yes. So years ago, when Victoza first came out, we started using Victoza in people with type 1 diabetes, regardless of whether they were new onset or not, early on with the same group out of the university at Buffalo, up in Buffalo, New York, and published several studies on the use of Victoza with type 1 liraglutide, which is a once daily. And so the same group of people said, wow, what could we do if these were new onset, right? What if we could preserve function of beta cells? What if we could make it less burdensome in the beginning of treatment altogether? So they looked at 10 people, right, between the of over 21 up to 39 years, newly diagnosed with residual C-peptide. So the first thing we need to realize when you see these headlines is not that this is going to replace insulin for those people that are not making insulin, right? These are people newly diagnosed. And when you're newly diagnosed with type 1, you have what is approximated to 10% pancreatic function left. So what happened was they said, okay, what's going on? Mean A1C was above 11. So these weren't, oh, gee, I barely have type 1. These were real, you know, true type 1, lots of them even had DKA at diagnosis. And they said, all right, but you still have some C-peptide. Let's give them some Ozempic, some semaglutide once a week and see what happens. Let's look at those outcomes. And the outcomes are pretty staggering, right? Everyone came off of mealtime insulin, which I think is important in the beginning. So, you know, they are using CGM. They could see what their values are. But they did. All of them came off of mealtime insulin altogether. You know, so that's a big deal to me, right? All of them, and basal insulin was eliminated in 7 patients within the first 6 months. And they were followed for a year. Beta cell function was actually went up. It was preserved. And A1Cs went down into the high 5s.
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite remarkable and definitely begs the question of, does semaglutide, does it allow regeneration of some of the beta cells? Certainly, it seems like it's protecting them from the decline. This was done in adults, so between the ages of 21 to 39. And at least in my experience, adults, often the onset can be a little slower progressing. So it definitely seems like introducing this really early on can offer some protection of not needing full-blown insulin right away. It's very fascinating data.
It is. And you know, I mean, when we talk about our love for technology, people with diabetes were able to obtain 89% time in range, right? With no low glucoses. The low glucoses that were reported when they were titrating the insulin up, I mean, the insulin down and the weekly semaglutide up, right? To note, they did start at half a dose. So we have this love of being able to titrate Ozempic in endocrinology, right? So if you look at that pen of that semaglutide, you know, there are two doses on it, 0.25 and 0.5, but you can count the clicks on the pens, and there are 72 clicks between, yeah, that priming dose and 0.5. So what they did was they counted the clicks and said, let's give them a half of 0.25 or 0.125, right? To give that person with diabetes a chance to get used to the drug and reduce the risk of low glucoses. all of the lows that were reported in that first titration period where they were lowering the insulin and increasing that semaglutide. So it is pretty exciting. And does it reduce the disease burden? You know, does it make it easier to start that education process? You know, lots of adults who are diagnosed with type 1, they don't count carbs before they get diagnosed with type 1. They're not ready for this, and they don't think about it. And all of a sudden, bam, here we go in the middle of their productive lives as adults, right? And so this, I believe that this will reduce disease burden. It gives you a slower process to get that education, knowing that one day you are going to end up, the beta cell destruction is going to continue to happen. So they looked at it at a year. That's their endpoint, and that's what this this letter to the editor, right? So this is a letter to the editor because this is not a randomized control trial. This is not, right? You don't get this in the New England Journal of Medicine without, you know, you don't publish the study. You write a letter to the editor. So those are the sort of my comments on the side of all of this, right? Is that, does this improve outcomes long term? Because you do have type 1, but you almost have as close to increased time in range as you're ever going to get.
Yeah. And they did titrate up to 0.5 milligrams. Yes. So yeah, it's interesting. They started off kind of at this like off-label dose. I mean, the whole thing's off-label, right? It's type 1, but they started at this lower dose, but eventually they did get to kind of at least the first maintenance dose. And yeah, we don't know about the long-term, but I think short-term, I mean, it's really valuable to not, as much as like, I love technology, we love technology. If you don't need to be on mealtime insulin, like that's going to be
a lot. Right.
A pump.
Right.
There was a study done out of Barbara Davis, I believe, that tested putting AID systems on patients like from the get-go, early on, the automated delivery. And while that does offer meeting the glucose goals and everything, they did not show any C-peptide preservation in doing that approach. So I do believe there's something very unique about the use of semaglutide and its ability to preserve these beta cell function. And a year, I mean, it's a long time. Even if it wears off at a year, that's still a year that people could kind of get used to the new diagnosis and kind of gradually learn that carbohydrate counting and the other things that can help in their long-term management. Plus, I mean, we have data from other studies just showing like the whole quote-unquote legacy effect of having good management early on, how that can really make a big difference long term in terms of reducing potential complications from diabetes. So
I also think we need to remember that, you know, the idea of having to change a pump and do all of that versus taking a once a week injection, right? There's no, you know, once that titration was done on the Ozempic up to that and the insulin is gone, there's no risk of low glucoses, right? There's no, it's a once a week go, you know? That certainly is a whole lot easier than maintaining a pump and a sensor, right? So there's that. But yeah. Then there's all these other thoughts, right? So now we have teplizumab, right? So that's for this, you know, this stage two, right, treatment, right? Stage two diabetes is you've got two positive antibodies and you're dysglycemic, but you don't have actual diabetes yet. You don't have a need for medication, but your fat, your postprandial numbers are high. Typically, you know, sometimes you're elevated fastings, but we know it's coming and we can use this drug called teplizumab and you're infused for a couple of weeks and it delays the onset of type one. We know that there's verapamil and data around verapamil in delaying and preserving that beta cell function, right? What now is that off? Now this is completely off label, as is this entire discussion, right? About do we add all of those together? Do I give someone a little bit of semaglutide plus their infusion of teplizumab plus some verapamil? What would that do? And I think that's where the excitement comes in: is how do we what do we do now as to where this comes from? What do we do, right?
Yeah,
and how do we get this done? Yeah.
Yeah. I was also thinking just with the whole introduction of teplizumab, there's a big push for screening because now we actually have a medication that can intervene if people are screened early. And so the advantage of screening, whether a person chooses to use teplizumab or not, is that you kind of know, okay, I'm going to develop type 1 diabetes. And so that makes it so much easier to intervene early on. Also, the ability to ideally prevent going into DKA. And so it's like, with more screening, hopefully we're just going to catch people earlier. And then we can take advantage of other things like the teplizumab, the verapamil, or potentially the semaglutide. And then I also just wanted to like talk about, so semaglutide, even though we're, this is off label for type 1, we are using it all the time in type 1 diabetes. Like, I just,
I want to get the message out there that it works.
It's okay. Yes. So I can't officially say it works because, right, we don't have randomized controlled trials published yet about it. But anecdotally, in our clinics, like, we see it's working really effectively. We're using drugs like semaglutide. We used liraglutide. We use tirzepatide. We've used dulaglutide. We use what we can get. But it works for people. It works to reduce their postprandial glucose, and especially in those with type 1 diabetes that also have overweight or obesity, it also has the beneficial impacts on the weight too. So I mean, I don't know. It's been great for outcomes for people.
When we can get it. So there's a couple of things. One is the data around the reduction of heart attacks and strokes, that major adverse cardiac events, with these GLP-1 and GLP-1, hopefully GIP, although, you know, the tirzepatide cardiovascular outcome data has not been published yet, right? We're all kind of in that clinical place of, do we assume that it's going to, do we not, right? But the data is so good that how do I not give this to somebody? How do I not offer it? You know, it's not going to help someone with type 1 that has no C-peptide to make the body make insulin. It's like, you know, you can't, it's not going to make insulin, but it's going to do the rest of what a GLP or GLP-GIP does for that person. It's going to delay that absorption of food in the digestive system so that when you do give insulin subcutaneously, it gives you a flatter curve for that postprandial rise because the insulin absorption matches a little bit better to the food absorption, right? It does send a message to the brain that says, I'm not as hungry, I don't need as much food, right? And it, you know, what I tell people with diabetes is it's just going to say to your liver, stop doing this, stop making so much stored glucose and spurting it out. Calm down, right? Calm down. And so it does those other things. It just, with type 1, doesn't make the pancreas make insulin. With this new letter to the editor, what they're saying is if you get it early enough, these people all have C-peptide values that are measurable. Of course, it's going to make insulin then, right? With the people with type 1 with no C-peptide left, it's doing those other things. But the real elephant in the room is getting it covered. So the coverage is such an issue. We can always try, but a lot of the times we can't get it covered. And you know, it's a question of how do we get it? How do you document a person? You know, they have type 1, they have type 1, right? And a lot of insurance companies have said these are very expensive drugs. We're not covering them if they're not FDA approved, right? And Victoza, early on, liraglutide, went through a very early staging of should we get this approved for type 1? And in the early studies, it didn't reduce hypoglycemia. So they stopped. And it's like, wait a minute, but you forgot about the heart benefit and you didn't look at, right? And there was no CGM. You know, now we're looking at how to use CGM in trials. What if I could reduce the lows? What if I can reduce that above 250, right? Is that enough to get an FDA approval on something? So I think now there is a trial with semaglutide for type 1, and I think they're doing a better job of looking at what outcomes are really important for people with type 1.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, liraglutide was studied. It was studied in randomized controlled trials, adjunct too. And there was actually some A1C lowering. Of course, I would have loved now to see time in range and all the other glucose metrics. But I think maybe one of the reasons they ultimately didn't pursue FDA approval, there was an increased risk of hypoglycemia. And we do know it's really important to monitor these patients. CGM is ideal. And that way you can adjust insulin so that hopefully you don't, there isn't more hypoglycemia. But to your point, semaglutide is definitely being studied, randomized controlled trials, as well as it looks like there's several studies kind of in the works, some large, some smaller ones. And so hopefully we'll get the data that's needed. And I would love to see this become FDA approved so that access and coverage for people with type 1 would just be more universal, because the patients that are able to get it right now generally do very, very well. And it's just unlike, I mean, in the past, and we still do sometimes, like we'll use metformin. Well, okay, metformin's like okay. And sometimes it has some effect, but what we're seeing with the GLP-1s is really just much more remarkable, I think, than what we've seen with metformin use of type 1.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And it's one of those where, you know, it is the class in and of itself is expensive enough that the majority of people cannot afford to just buy it, right? I can write a prescription for anyone that wants it, but the coverage is very, very, you know, it's very rare that we can actually get someone through, you know, so that's where the biggest hurdle is. I want our listeners and our viewers to understand it will be years before we get coverage, I mean, get approval for type 1. So now there's some smaller randomized control trials that will be followed by larger randomized control trials that will be followed by, right? So this is a long process, but I love the fact that they're looking again, that they were willing to go back and say, maybe we should look at this differently, right? And cardiovascular outcome trials will take years upon years upon years before we see something like that actually be published.
Yeah, but what we did talk about recently, the SELECT trial, at least the top line results showing the favorable cardiovascular risk reduction in people with cardiovascular disease and overweight or obesity using semaglutide. And so if that, once that becomes published, I am hopeful that will increase access, at least to those with overweight and obesity. And so hopefully
maybe that will come, right? Exactly. Right. In spite of your type one, you, right. Exactly. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. I agree. So that is another option, is maybe we get it covered differently, right? We cover it for you being overweight or obese versus being having type 1 diabetes, right? So you have overweight or obesity, and we'll put it under that code versus the type 1 code, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Super exciting.
Super exciting. Super exciting. So thank you everyone for tuning in to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. Have a great day.